I remembered who I am. You know, I remembered it. I remembered it. And that's when I said to myself, I will not be defeated. I will not be defeated. I'm not buried. I'm not. I'm planted.
Welcome to the Tango Tango podcast. Real, raw, and unfiltered conversations with veterans and those who support them. Tune in, be inspired, and walk away stronger.
Welcome to the Tango Tango podcast. I'm your host, Lloyd Knight. This podcast is brought to us by our friends at Supply Chain Now. I'm super excited for today's episode. I've been following Mac on social media for many years. I'm a huge fan. Just as a quick introduction, and I've got this list here. Mac is a Delta Force veteran, a small business owner, a fitness guru, Basic Dude Stuff creator, which I flippin' love, Basic Dude Stuff, a social media master, kid show host, which we're going to be talking about now, which just looks totally cool, owner of some really cool toys, including a GTO goat, the all-around ultimate badass, king of dad jokes, which I think are hilarious, and then husband of Rebecca. So welcome to the Tango Tango, Mac.
Thanks, Lloyd. Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
And we're going to go a little bit different. We're not going to dig into the whole veteran thing yet and talk about your background. Let's talk about Rebecca.
Oh, my God.
Because I know Rebecca came into your life at a great opportunity. I've heard the story, and you credit her for kind of giving you some really needed guidance in your life.
Yeah, she pretty much gave me like a second lease on life. You know, when I met her, 2013, remet. Yeah. I was in a pretty bad place, and I was pretty sure that I wouldn't get into another long-term relationship again, just because the previous one was really bad. And anyway, she is, she's an extraordinary human being. She's, I like to tell people she's one of the best all-around human beings that I've ever met. We met briefly in probably 2011. I went to pick up my then wife, who was under the influence, at Rebecca's hair salon. And we chatted briefly, you know, this and that. Her boyfriend took a course for me. So we chatted briefly, 5 minutes or so. And then I re-met her a year and a half ago. We were both single. And it didn't take long, man. I mean, man, it's all the corny stuff you always hear, you know, soulmates and all this stuff, you know. But I never knew. And I think I was 48 years old when I met Rebecca. I had never known true love until I met her.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I thought I had, but never. I mean, it was a whole new ball of wax. We have an age difference. Most people know this. You know, it's an age difference. She's 25 years age difference.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I'm a guy, so therefore I'm 5 minutes out of high school perpetually. She's the responsible adult in my life. She's my executive assistant, and we're tight. We are best of buds. I mean, I think first and foremost, we're best of buds. You know, like, not she is my best friend. We're really tight buddies, you know, where we like to do everything together. We hang out. If we're separated for a day, for whatever reason, I miss her.
Well, congrats.
Yeah, that's yeah. I could go on awesome. And on. I mean, I could talk about her for, I could go.
That's really cool. The God gave me a second lease too. I was married for almost 34 years, and my wife passed away.
Bummer.
And then he granted me a second woman who is my friend and
nice.
And who puts up with me as well.
Nice.
And so I'm totally blessed.
Right on.
So yeah, I know that's so important to you. I've seen her mentioned multiple times, and she's on all your Basic Dude Stuff for most of them. So it's a very cool story, and I wanted to get into that first and foremost. Mm-hmm. So now let's take it back a little bit. Where are you originally from?
Originally from Connecticut. So grew up there.
Okay.
And, you know, most of my family, that's where they're from, either between Connecticut and Michigan, those two states. But most of my family is from Connecticut, and several of them still live there. But I left there in 1983 when I joined the Army.
So were you a big outdoorsman, hiker before you joined the
Army?
Yeah,
I think I was always drawn to the outdoors. I was a very curious kid, always into exploring and, you know, looking at bugs and birds. I've been an avid bird watcher since I was 10 years old. Oh. I learned how to fly fish when I was about 9 or 10 as well. I've always been big into the outdoors. Grew up in an area that had plenty of woods around us. So we were always, my friends and I were always in the woods. We had hiking trails and such, trails that we forged ourselves, you know, kind of burnt them into the landscape ourselves. So yes.
So what kind of high school student were you?
My first 2 years in high school, I did not do well. I struggled ADD. But back then, you know, you didn't take pills for it and such. You did this thing called exercise, and you did this thing called get outside. You know, you did this thing called create a bunch of hobbies for yourselves. But funny story there. I started wrestling in my freshman year of high school, and I sucked. I sucked my first 2 years, but I started getting really good, 11th and 12th grade. And then a bunch of things happen all at once. You know, you get your driver's license. And I had been working under the table just around the neighborhood. And then I started getting a couple part-time jobs after school. And insurance is expensive. My parents didn't, you know, parents don't pay your insurance and stuff like that for you. You want to drive, go get insurance. You want to drive, go get a car. You know, those kind of things.
Yeah.
But Allstate, I remember this, had a deal. Said if you were an honor grad student, your insurance would be cut 50%. So I was motivated. Wow. Yeah, motivated by money. And I studied.
Yeah.
I applied myself. Got on the honor roll. So, yep. So I ended up being a pretty good high school student my 11th and 12th year.
That's awesome. What kind of car were you driving?
The first car I ever bought, I bought it when I was 15, before I had a driver's license. And it was a 1954 Chevy Bel Air with a three on the tree. Yep. Straight six, 235. And I tinkered with it and got it painted, made it look sharp. And yeah, it was kind of the...
Wow, you were much cooler than me. I was sporting a 1982 yellow Chevy Love pick up a truck.
Yeah, not as cool. That car's not as cool. Right. No, yep.
Not as cool. Yeah, I wrestled too. Wrestling really laid a foundation for me. You have nobody to blame when you're counting the lights on your back.
Right.
And you ultimately get tired of being pinned. So you either work your butt off and then you learn. Or you quit, and I ended up wrestling for 3 years, and I can't say I was super good, but I was good enough where I was doing more pinning than getting pinned.
Right on, that's what it's about, right there. Same. Once I won my first match, I wanted more of that feeling of being victorious, and it was a new sensation to me, being victorious in something. And so you become self-governed, you know you're part of a team, but if you want to represent the team well, you've got to win matches. If you want to win matches, you've got to be self-governed. You got to put in the extra road miles and the extra training and the extra weight room, and you can't just practice, you know, during team practice.
Yeah it's a 24/7 mm-hmm. commitment. Yep. Almost to get good. Did you have a break between high school and the Army, or did you join right away?
I had a 1.5 month break.
Okay. And why the Army?
I went to, I think because of wrestling and being, you know, liking the teamwork, the camaraderie, the discipline, I thought, man, I really want to join the military. My dad was pushing me to become an officer. You know, he really wanted me to go to an academy at West Point, Air Force Academy, whatever it was. And thankfully, I wasn't blessed with the aptitude for those kind of, you know, institutions. So I went to Recruiter Row, you know, and talked to all the recruiters. You know, they're you know how they are. They're like wolves circling a carcass, you know. And the Army had the best answer for me at the time because I asked them all the same question. It was just dumb kid question, 17-year-old cocky kid. What's the hardest thing I could do in the Air Force, in the Marine Corps, in the Navy, in the Army? And the Army had the best answer because they had two tracks, like fast tracks to badassery. They had Army Rangers or Special Forces. At the time, Special Forces was taking people off of the street. It was an SF baby program, 18 X-ray. Yeah. So once you finished 13 weeks of infantry basic AIT, you went to jump school and you would start a Special Forces course. So that's why. I had no druthers one way or another. I had no allegiance or loyalty to a certain branch of service. I didn't care.
And what year was that?
I enlisted, delayed entry in 1982 when I was 17 and went in as soon as I graduated high school in 1983.
Okay, great. Talk us through the Q course because we have a lot of folks that listen and watch this podcast that aren't veterans or haven't been around the military. Mm-hmm.
A little bit run a little differently then than it is now. When I reported to Fort Bragg, we started and I reported on my 19th birthday. That's when I got to Fort Bragg, March 4th, 1984. And they had this thing called pre-phase initially, which was nothing more than trim the fat. It was just a 3-week smoke fest. You were living in, old World War II wooden barracks. You weren't getting a lot of sleep. You weren't getting a lot of food. You were going. A lot of shit details and just a lot of smoke fest. It was nothing more than let's see who wants to be here. Do you really want to be here or do you just want to wear a green beret? You know, that kind of thing. So, I mean, you PT probably 3 times a day, probably. You know, and there was no rhyme or reason to it. It was, you know, grass drills and sprint 2 miles as fast as you can and just push-ups until you felt like your shoulders were going to explode. There was no rhyme or reason to it. It was just a smoke. Just smoke the living crap out of you. When I started what was called, it still is called, first phase, that was out of Camp McCall. And Camp McCall was unique. In that time, it was just tar paper shacks. It was very Spartan. You know, they have a barracks there now and stuff and buildings. It was very Spartan. And first phase is where you learn the basic skills. So, you know, all your rope stuff, your fries, your rappelling, your fast rope, your survival, your land nav, your patrolling, all those things. And in between getting instruction on all those things, you were still getting smoked, you know, just smoke ruck marches. That was mainly it. Get that ruck on at 4 a.m. Follow the leader down freaking dirt roads and the pace. I remember the pace going, wow. Cause I was a young stud, but there's a real art form to rucking. So I was one of maybe 5 of me, SF babies, kids. The experienced guys came from Ranger Battalion, 82nd Airborne Division, those things. They know how to ruck, you know, the staff sergeants, the guys who are old, you know, 25 years old, you know what I mean? They were old. they could ruck, you know, they could move out. So that alone, I was just blown away. There was so much to learn, you know, what do you know when you're 19? You're dumber than a brick with a hole in it. You don't know anything. Yeah. So the SF course required a lot of... It was a thinking man's game. You couldn't just be a nug. It was very cerebral, a lot of study. And it was not easy for me. The first phase was not easy. As a matter of fact, I failed out of first phase and had to recycle the whole thing, the first phase. And then once you finish first phase, you go into second phase, which is your job specialty. And in Special Forces, you have 18 Bravo, 18 Delta, 18 Echo, 18 Charlie, right? So you were a heavy weapons guy, engineer, medic, or weapons guy. And I went to 18 Bravo weapons school, and that was 8 weeks long, where you're learning all the world's weapons. You know, you could disassemble and assemble these things in the dark. I don't care what it was. You know, if it was an M2HB or a Sten, you know, you knew all of the guns. And you were able to shoot all of the guns. You knew the history behind them. You know, you had to take written tests on these things. You had to know how to repair them, how to set headspace and timing, all this stuff. And then in third phase, oh my God, man, that became like, that's when you learned like the guerrilla warfare, unconventional warfare. And you had to, you know, work with, and it's a, in the Special Forces course, a fictional guerrilla outfit, you know, and here it's, it's Pineland. And so it's a fictional country.
I know about Pineland.
It's a fictional country, and the exercise is called Robin Sage. There are role players who've been playing for, I have no idea, but I guarantee you there are role players who have played for 50 years.
Wow.
Yeah, I guarantee you there are people who, who started being a role player when they were a teenager and they're still doing the same thing now, you know, however many times a year they run Robin Sage, guarantee you those people are still out there. You know, it's kind of a neat thing for the community too, to be a member of Pineland, you know, a citizen of the country of Pineland.
I read Tim Kennedy's book, which I thought was a pretty dang good book. And he talks about having it, getting a fresh uniform, get wet and roll around in the sand.
Yeah. Right.
And I thought it was a pretty good depiction. One of the things that surprised me, is getting to know Navy SEALs and Green Berets and the Special Forces community is it's more than just muscle and might and how cerebral they are and how great of a memory you have to have.
The amount of stuff that you learn, not just when you're going through a course, but over the span of a career. I don't know. I probably have the equivalent of two master's degrees because everything from math, from all the math, from geometry to algebra to trigonometry. And then you have to know laws like Boyle's law, Dalton's law, Archimedes' principle. You have, there's so much learning that goes into this stuff. And, you know, the leadership training and the writing skills and the writing courses. And it just goes on and on and on. The wheels on the bus go round and round and round. And you're going, especially if you want to level up, which Special Forces gives you that opportunity to level up continuously. So you're always looking for the next thing. What haven't I done? What school don't I have under my belt? So you're always faced with a new set of challenges, brand new set of challenges.
So you you went through airdrop school,
yep.
paratrooper school, Fort Benning, and so how was that jumping out of an airplane for the first
time? You know what? I think when you're first doing it, they're all night jumps, right? Because your eyes are shut. Now, that's what they say. It wasn't horrible. It's very nervous inside the plane. Yeah. You're very nervous because you're jammed in there with 60 other people, and you're a kid. Because most people go through jump school kids, 18. 19. And you know, you're tethered off to a cable inside and the racket, you know, in there and the commands, because the jump masters for jump school are very theatrical and they're yelling and screaming. And when the doors open on that bird and the wind rushes in, you're going, oh my God. And go, you know, and they're just pushing guys out, pushing them out. I was injured on my second jump.
Oh,
I was what is referred to as a toad jumper.
So I'm a loadmaster, a retired loadmaster.
Right.
141s.
Yep.
So we train for toad jumpers. Yep. And it's about as dangerous as it gets.
Yep.
And there's different levels of it. So, let's take us through that story.
Yeah. So I have a 5-inch scar on this arm right here because probably my fault, right? I probably chucked the static line and, you know, had my arms flailing, but the static line went under my reserve and around my arm. I was like halfway in the stick and boom, I hit the end of that and I'm stuck on the outside of the airplane. I'm smashing into it. Jumpers are coming over me and it, thankfully it came loose. Right.
You're lucky.
Right.
Because I mean, it's the common people die.
Oh, it was very, very scary. And I had, that was my first injury. Like, this is a legit injury, not a broken arm or a broken collarbone, but I am injured. I ended up with my bicep got pulled down into my forearm, kind of toothpaste tube down, broke ribs, dislocated shoulder, concussion. But it's kind of, I like to find humor in some of my tragedy, which most of my tragedy I could find humor in, except for like going through a deep, dark depression. You know, I can't find humor in that, but all my injuries, bad luck, I could find a lot of humor, especially the toe jumper thing. When it came loose, my chute deployed. I'm under my chute and I just remember groaning, you know, very shocky at that point because the body takes over. You know, it's trying to shut down and calm you down. Just groaning, moaning and groaning. And I hit the ground and I land on the same side, you know, broken rib side. And I'm laying there in agonizing pain and I'm just motionless. And add insult to injury. Gust of wind comes. Whoosh, my chute inflates. And I'm getting drug across the drop zone, you know, like a sack of freaking turds, just getting drug across the drop zone. And I hear one of the instructors on a bullhorn, you know, one of the black hats, and he's yelling at me. You leg, you over there getting drug, release one of your cable loop type canopy release assemblies now, leg, release it now. You know, and I did that. I reached up with this arm and I popped that thing and shoot deflate.
Yeah.
Now, because you're 18 and you've been injured in a school, you think the only thing that was on my mind is I'm in trouble. I messed something up. I damaged government property, you know, that kind of thing. So I packed my stuff up with one arm, and it was very, very scary to me because there was no signal from my head to my arm. There was I remember like saying to myself, please move, please move, you know, and there was nothing. It wouldn't move. So I got all my stuff in and I sat down and I'm very ashen and I'm puking. I threw up and I could see all the instructors. They're looking around. Well, they're looking for me because they saw it. Yeah. You know, they saw it happen. Yeah. And a buddy of mine comes up and I got rope burns around my BDUs. You know, and he says, bro, are you okay? I said, I'm not good. I'm not good. And he unbuttoned my shirt. And I'm looking at him, and that's when it really, when he pulled the shirt down and I saw like the skin was like translucent and there was no bicep and that big bump in my forearm. That's when I threw up again. And then the black hats ran over and they were super professional. So they said, all right, we're going to get you out of here. Another add insult to injury. The medevac bird just left. Right. Oh. Yeah. It was somebody with a broken femur. So I had to take a bus, one of the Bluebird buses, by myself, all the way to Martin Army Hospital, down dirt roads. And it's bumping around, and you know, I'm like Ace Ventura. I'm going, oh my! And I mean, I was in absolute freaking agony. Third insult to injury, I get to Martin Army Hospital, and it's right after Grenada, so the hospital has a lot of combat jump injuries in it. You know, like real injuries, combat, you know, like aircraft seizure. Yeah. I mean, airfield seizure, you know, where they were jumping out 450 feet. So, and they stick me in an open bay with, there must have been 20 other patients in the open bay. And I'm just in agony. And thankfully, the guy in the bed next to me was a master sergeant from 1st Ranger Battalion. And he says, toe jumper, huh? I said, yes, sergeant. And he gets on the horn and calls the nurse. He said, give this guy some drugs now. Because they hadn't given me anything.
Wow. Yeah. Holy cow.
Yeah. So he took care of me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they shot.
So how long were you out for before you could continue training?
That happened in September 1983. And I graduated jump school in February. All right. So a couple months. In Martin Army.
Wow.
Yep.
That's true.
And once again, the staff at jump school, true professionals. My third jump, they put me first in the door. They were real cool about it, you know, because they knew. They put me first in the door, and I remember the jump master grabbing my static line going and looking at me like, this is not getting the best of you this time.
That's that's amazing. So I was a 141 load master. I remember the first time and airdrop school, getting trained on how to kick people out of the airplane.
Right.
The first time I had to open up the door and step out on the platform, I was like, what in the world am I doing? And
that's fun. Yeah, that's a but good feeling.
I was like,
feeling a power, you know, it's fun. It's jump master school.
You know, it, Yeah, and ultimately, I thrived in it. Yeah. So the it was such a rush, but that first time was pretty shocking. Mm-hmm. But I loved going down to Benny and the airdrop school.
Yep.
Because it was pretty easy for us. We would just open up the doors and do racetracks, mm-hmm. and then you know, we would load up one after another. They would do five jumps in one day, yep. and then they watched the progression of between the jumps. And then honestly, the jump masters, as you said, they were so good,
right?
And it was it was such an honor to do that.
Very cool.
So complete the Q course. So how long was the Q course?
For me or for a normal person? Let me see. March.
For you.
I think March to November is how long I was there. Because the other thing, too, as a private, you know, as a 18 X-ray, you know, as a baby, you did not get priority. Like whenever you start phase two, for example, there was lag time here and there, plus recycling first phase. So it took a minute. And from there, I went to our first Special Forces group at Fort Lewis, Washington.
At the height of the Cold War.
Yep. Height of the Cold War.
So it's a much different environment now. I remember, you know, every training that we did. So I joined in 1987, mm-hmm. and from 1987 until the wall fell, everything we did was trained against the Soviet threat.
Yep. It's all Soviet. Yep. The great freaking propaganda machine, you know. And it's so funny because I ended up landing a job during the Cold War spying on the Soviet army. And I went, they don't look so freaking superpower-ish to me. I mean, the troops, very hardy, very tough. They got nothing on us, bro. They're like living 100.
They train hard.
Yeah.
I mean, they train real life conditions. And
they're hardy. They don't know any better. Just the way they're brought up. You know, most kids in like Russia probably had a handful of fist fights by the time they were 5 years old.
Yeah.
No, I mean, for real, they're very, very hardy. That was the only thing. But like their leadership, their corruption, their equipment was in a horrible state of disrepair. It was antiquated. It was just a mess. But the soldiers, very tough.
Yeah, I think we saw that at when the Russian-Ukraine war started. They had the same stuff decades later going on.
Right.
I remember, you know, all their tires of all their vehicles were dry rotting.
Right.
And they definitely didn't have the acquisition arm that the U.S. military had. So mm-hmm. Let's talk about, can you share like a memorable mission that you went on?
In which part of my life?
Let's start off with an early one.
The so first group, no mission, you know, peacetime army.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Nothing going on. We just trained to beat the freaking Soviet Union.
Exactly.
And we did a lot of FID, foreign internal defense.
Yep.
But as soon as I went overseas, especially to what was called USMLM, United States Military Liaison Mission, where I was spying on the Soviet Army, that was a wake-up call. This is like, holy shit, this is no holds barred. You can't mess this up. Because they reserve the right to execute you. You're in their territory. You do not have complete autonomy here. It's a game of cat and mouse. They know what you are doing. It became a lesson in life in that you can't make mistakes. And there's several memorable times, especially getting chased. The first time you get chased by a piece of Soviet kit. Because a lot, like I said, it was in a horrible state of disrepair, but a lot of it was really badass. You know, I mean, take a BMP, for example, BMP one or BMP two. It's like the Velociraptor of the kit world, you know, the agility of those things and how fast they can move over tank trails. It's really impressive. But man, I've been chased on dirt roads by the likes of SS-21s, BMP, BMP-2, BMP-1, Beater 70s, Beater 60s, PTS, T-72.
What were you in when you were being chased?
Mercedes Geländewagen. Highly modified.
Yeah,
really? Yep, highly modified, militarized, right down to turbo and diff locks and all this stuff. And you went to special driving schools for this machine, and you know, you're driving under nods, and at the time it was PVS5s, you know, you didn't have anything high speed. And you're navving off of 1/24,000 topographical scale maps too. That's how you're navving with a trip meter in front of you under nods.
I'm thinking of what's coming to my mind is that you're gonna laugh and call me a dumbass airman. The Chuck Norris Delta Force when they're in the Mercedes.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Trying to get out of the submarine and driving in the Mercedes.
Right, right. The amount of times I found myself in different vehicles is ridiculous throughout my career.
Yeah, you don't picture that, right? You picture somebody in always military grade equipment.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember the first time I loaded Delta Force on my airplane. I was really young, maybe 19, and my instructor was like, "Forget everything you're gonna see," and the equipment was amazing.
Right.
And so very different.
What year was that? First time you loaded them on?
1988.
Okay. I was hoping maybe it was during my tenure, because I would have said, "Hey, I might have been on your plane then."
you never know. Yep. So let's talk about the journey from first completing the Q course, the Delta Force.
Yeah. So I landed a couple Cold War jobs right after from First Special Forces Group. Really fortunate. I mean, most people have no idea that they existed. I didn't know that they existed. You know, people in the SF community didn't know they existed. And I was there for, you know, the wall coming down in 1981 all the way to reunification in 1991. But when the wall came down or reunification, I was like, well, what's the next step? I've been Special Forces. I'm a Whiskey 9, Combat Dive, Halo, 2 SFMOSs. I've had a couple Cold War jobs. There's only one option. You got to try out for Delta now. You have to, if you want to level up. I landed a slot, went to selection, and the first big movement, which is like on day one, I broke my ankle.
Oh.
Yeah, the amount of schools I failed is ridiculous. I mean, I am the master of failing and recovering.
Yeah.
So broke my ankle, and I ended up walking on it for another week. It was the swelling was so bad that I had to cut the sides of my boots so I could fit my foot in there. And then I just duct tape the boot together around my foot. Yeah. So that was a daily occurrence. But they gave me the opportunity to try again.
All right.
And I'm like, damn straight. You give me the opportunity, I am doing it. And the second time I did, you know, I did well. And man, what a feeling that was. And then when you get there, though, there's a level of ego, you know, in every special ops guy's.
Yep, absolutely.
In his mind, in his heart.
A requirement.
And prior to going to Delta, I was always like top tier. I was that top tier guy, you know, performer, all around performer. I get there, and it's welcome to mediocre. You don't know shit. You know nothing. Yeah.
Wow, it was that different.
Oh my God.
That much of a bar.
I mean, it was like, what in the hell? I thought I'd do stuff. The difference was night and day. And the amount of responsibility, you know, that you had and accountability, all that stuff. It was night and day. Night and day. And you always found yourself trying to level up. Well, you know, you want to get better. It's just like the wrestling thing. You're a part of the team and you train with the team. You want to be a team asset, team player. But if you want to get better, you got to put in the extra hours. Just like, you know, the wrestling thing. Right? You've got to be self-governed, which means you came in earlier to do extra PT, which means you stay later, you know, which meant you come in on the weekends. Sometime it could be a Sunday morning at 2 a.m. to go do night fire on your own, which was permissible and encouraged. But you were always trying to level up because there's always somebody better, no matter how good I got there. And I ended up being, you know, I would say a very respectful top tier operator. But man, I mean, there were always somebody. that could do this better, that better, this better, that better, always. So yeah, it was quite an experience. I'm so fortunate to have spent 13 years there.
13 years.
Yep. Wow. My last 13 years.
So how long was that school?
Well, the selection course is only a few weeks. I don't even know. Okay. Even though I've supported it like three times.
Yeah.
And there's a massive attrition rate, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
It's like a 80 to 90% attrition rate in selection. And then the school, the OTC, the operators trainers course, is 6 months. And when I say 6 months, it's like 6 months. There's no break.
Yeah.
You're just going the whole time. I mean, it's 6 months. There's no like, let's take a freaking long weekend or this and that. No, it's 6 months.
That's great.
Yeah. And then you think you know something. And then you go and join a Saber squadron. And then you realize, I don't know squat. Nothing. Yeah.
So your first assignment after that was, explain what a Saber squadron is.
The basically the assaulters, you know, guys, the door kickers. Yep.
All right.
Yep. Guys are doing the heavy lifting, you know, the mission ready guys on the bubble.
All right. Yep. Can you talk about a memorable mission that you had in the Delta Force?
Yeah. I think one of the real cool ones for me early on was not early on, but while I was, you know, just getting a little more seniority, was doing some stuff in Bosnia, policing up the PIFWIKs, right, the persons indicted for war crimes.
Yeah.
And I did five of those, but I won't get into detail about them too much, you know?
Yeah.
But there was one that we were just speculating, like, this could happen. You know, what could happen? When could it happen? We were the masters of that. You know, you create your own luck type of thing. You set the stage, you create what may happen. And we just spitballing, you know, we're like, we might have to go police these guys up. And here's the course of action based on what I saw on the ground of how we could get these guys. And the first one we got, this guy, General Kristic, we trained for about a year with no mission task list.
Wow.
We trained about a year, and then we get a mission. And then we trained another 2 months, and then we went and got him. And the mission itself took about a minute and 35 seconds.
Get out.
So a year and 2 months training, minute 35 seconds.
So I'm guessing if it was that short, it went really well.
Really well. Yep.
Yeah, really well.
Yep. No mission goes as planned, ever.
No.
It never goes as planned. So, but it went as smoothly as possible. Very few hiccups, you know, a couple little freaking aw shits, but nothing huge.
One of my first episodes of the podcast, I had John Thompson, who was commander of the Night Stalkers during the Bin Laden raid. And then I asked him about that helo crashing, or as he would call it, a controlled landing.
Right.
He goes, it wasn't, they trained for it. So it wasn't, nobody panicked. It wasn't even that much of a shock. They just, the training kicked in the gear and they were able to overcome it.
Yeah, I've been in several of those hard landings.
I bet.
You know, if a helicopter lands on its side or turns over like that, it's just a hard landing. It's not a crash.
Were you ever scared?
I'm sure. I have to think about not during any like mission stuff, but I was scared in training it several times.
Yeah.
But training is always harder.
Yeah.
You know,
interesting enough, out of all those years of flying, and I did flight tests and some really crazy stuff, I never got scared until years later, until after I retired. Right. And then I look back on it now, like, oh, what in the world?
Absolutely.
And then,
yep.
Yeah.
Yep. It's like that. Just like that. Right. Same.
So you went on to retire as a sergeant major. Yep. Did you ever think that was going to happen when you first joined the Army?
No, I was flying by the seat of my pants, you know? No, I was in it for the excitement, the fun, the camaraderie, the hardship, the training. I was in it for all that, for, I guess, all the right reasons, not let me see if I could make rank.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't.
And how many years did you spend in?
22.
22. Wow. Sergeant major retired at 22. That's you did well. And why'd you get out?
Oh man, it's a little ugly, but I had little kids and their mom was not well. Product of the mental health system, a lot of drinking involved, a lot of pills. And I had to get out for their benefit because they were not being looked after. So, yeah, I always, you know, there's always shoulda, woulda, coulda in the back of my head.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, that's always, you know, you're going to have shoulda, woulda, coulda. And you had a, I talk a lot about transition, you know, my day job, I've been at UPS for 18 years where, and over the last 2+ years, I've been in charge of veteran recruiting and really take great pride in helping veterans transition. And on the surface, you look like you had a great transition.
Yep.
But I know I've heard enough of your story. You didn't. You went to go work for a big company. You had all that stuff going on with your wife, which caused you to drink and treat yourself. You were depressed. Mm-hmm. You got laid off with that company, and things were gone in a very wrong direction for you. And you were able to. I love the way you talk about it. You had to fix yourself.
I didn't count on anybody else. I mean, it was like a spiritual awakening of sorts. Yeah, I landed a job before I retired with a corporation who wanted me to build a training company for them. And I did that. And about 4+ years into that, I got laid off and on the phone too, you know. Which totally. It's like, what does that even mean? I don't understand this, because you never think about job security while you're in the military. And then you're working for a corporation that does a lot of government contract stuff, and you're working with a bunch of retired military guys. So you figure, you know, it's similar job security. So got laid off because it was a money thing. They got bought out. So they were laying off. It was like 5 of us, I think, who got laid off because we were full-time guys and they just wanted to hire the contractors, pay bits and pieces here and there. And that was pretty scary. That was very scary.
Yeah, I bet it was scary, especially when you got all this other stuff in the background going on.
Yep, all that other crap and, you know, little kids, bills to pay, a wife who didn't support me. It's almost like she wanted me to fail.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was real spooky. That was 2010. But I immediately generated my own company, T-Max Inc., and almost immediately started getting work. And they were big government contract jobs, federal law enforcement, military type of stuff. So, yeah. But the marriage was going south in a hurry, you know, just nosediving. Yeah. And I was taking care of two little – I was working my butt off, coming home, taking care of two little kids, and taking care of my drug addict wife. And – I just felt, and there was no support for me. It was just beat down, beat down, beat down, beat down, beat down. It was nonstop. It was nonstop. It was a everlasting, perpetual motion machine of negativity and just constant beratement. Nothing you did was right. And, you know, it's hard to withstand that for any type of duration. And for me, it was.
Yeah. I mean,
duration was
when you have 360 of that, that's how a lot of veterans put a gun in their mouth.
Yep. I lived in the bonus room above my garage for 5 years.
5 years in the bonus room.
Bonus room above my garage. It's a little case.
So, what was the first step to get you out of that funk?
Kids. You know, I remember being pretty hammered. It was only like 8 at night. Been drinking all day. And my son. Was sitting next because they would come up all the time and watch TV with me. They needed escape too from their mom.
Yeah.
So they would hang out with me and we'd watch, you know, Simpsons or whatever, just watch a bunch of goofy cartoons. Yeah. And I tell this story a lot, only because I like to recollect it. But James and I were sitting in my bonus room. Imagine, you know, it's very small, it's kind of cabin-like. It's got an A-frame, you know, you could touch the roof in any position. And there's a little teeny window in it, you know, and there's a big willow tree out in front. And it's dark in in that room. We had one small lamp, incandescent light bulb. So the room is filled with this yellow, warm yellow, and a little TV. And we're sitting on my futon because I had a couch and it doubled as a bed. And that's what I slept in for 5 years. And we're looking at the TV, and I see something out of the corner of my eye at the window. And I look at the window, and a screech owl lands right on the window. The window's open. So it lands right there, right on the windowsill. And I'm looking at it. And it's 6 feet away. You know, it's right there. And I whisper, I go, James. He goes, yeah. I said, real slow, look at the window. And I could see him turning that way. And I'm still looking at the hour, but I could see out of my peripheral vision him going like that. You know, the owl's turning, looking outside, back in.
Yeah.
Looking back in. And then it takes off. And I look at him when it took off. And he was like, that was cool. And I look at this little kid with his big brown eyes and stuff. And I said, and that kind of hit me right then too. Dude, I got to take care of these kids. I got to be around. I said, James, I don't just love you. I am in love with you. And he started crying. Wow. Yeah. So that was pretty powerful. We hung out there for a little bit longer. I put him to bed and I sat on the edge of my futon and just thought, man, I got to get my shit together. Cause I was giving up. I was capitulating to darkness. I was done. I was like, I could live at rock bottom. I was just, you know, but I sat on the edge of my bed and I set an alarm clock. Next morning was, I think it was Sunday. I think this is a Saturday night, so Sunday. And I set it for 6 a.m. And I put my running shoes out and a pair of shorts and my iPod. And I said, I'm going to go for a run tomorrow morning. Alarm clock rang. I put my stuff on and went for a run. And I had no plan in mind. It was like, I ran for more than an hour. I know that. Right. Hour and 15 minutes. I come back in my driveway and I'm looking at this home and I just hate it. I call it the home where dreams go to die.
Ooh.
I was in a bad place. Yeah. But that run, and then I work out in my driveway for another hour. Just up, down, push-ups, sit-ups, you know, just dumbbells. And man, I remember feeling rejuvenated, you know, like I remembered who I am. You know, I remembered it. I remembered it. And that's when I said to myself, I will not be defeated. I will not be defeated. I'm not buried. I'm not. I'm planted. Watch me grow out of this hole. Yep. So that was my, I had so many second leases on life. Yeah. That was one of them right there too.
Wow, that brother, that gives me chills. So that's great to visualize it, but how did you do it?
I just made the decision to go for a run.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't.
But what was next after that?
Oh, right. Oh, yeah. So there was a sequence of events that happened directly after that. One was I felt alone. I was all alone. Nobody knew. Nobody knew how bad. I didn't, you know, whine and piss and moan at anybody about. Yeah. How I was feeling. Cause I just put on a front. I'm Pat Mac, get you some, gas it up, burn it down, blah, blah, you know, I just did all that.
Yeah.
It was a big front. And I had no support mechanism, nobody. My kids were my only out, you know, they were my vehicle of escapism. I did everything with them. And right after that, it wasn't, but days after that run, and I'm still, you know, I'm fired up now. Cop comes to my house, and I knew a local cop, and he says, hey, your wife's in the village, and she's out of her gourd. She's stoned on something, you know, this and that. And I brush it off. I'm like, all right, cool. I'll go pick her up, you know, humma, humma. And this cop looked at me, and they had been at my house 5-6 times in the past couple of years, because she would call, you know, because I was, I don't know, bugging the phones or manipulating the TV through my cell phone while I was in Texas, or, you know, that I had women living in her closet. She was very, very delusional. When people say all women are crazy, they don't understand the term crazy. You know, women can be bitches, Great. Good. I don't care. I could deal with that. But legit crazy, like no connection between the neuroreceptors. And she would have like all the sockets taken off of all the outlets, all the covers, showing the cops, like, see these blue washers in here?
He's playing
a bug in the house. And then, you know, and this girl lives in the closet. She tries on my shoes. Her name is Skeeter. She had names for you, Skeeter, Magpie. There were a couple of them. So anyway, they knew.
Yeah.
So this cop says, he comes up to me. He's like right in my face. He goes, hey, you need to get the hell out of here. And I said, huh? He says, you need to take radical steps. The kids are resilient. I know you're here for the kids. They will survive through this. And dude, this is the first time that I ever had anybody, you know, support me or understand or give me some kind of empathy on this. And I broke down, bro. I had no idea that was even in me.
Wow.
Yeah, I just fell apart. And the next day I moved out based on what that cop said. So he and periodically I still see him around and I always thank him. I was like, bro, you saved my freaking life and maybe my kid's life and probably saved me from freaking putting a bullet in my head or whatever. You know, who knows? But you saved my life. And I think that's important for people too, is recognize the signs, you know, be preemptive, that kind of stuff. But I found a condo. The next day I found a condo. It's 500 yards from where I lived. So now I'm still close to the kids, you know.
Right. Yeah.
And that was 2013, March.
How long after that did Rebecca come on the scene?
That was March, or let me say April 1st. April, May, June, July, August, end of August, beginning of September. So about 5 months.
Right.
Yep.
And how did the last we heard, she was had a boyfriend that went through your course.
Right. But now so this is a year and a half later.
Yeah. So how did that?
So she went to the West Coast with him, you know, after we met, and it just fell apart. He was a good guy, really bad boyfriend, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Good guy, sucks at being a boyfriend, but, and she's her own person, man. She does not mess around. She's very disciplined. She's very governed, self-governed. She's very extremely intelligent. So yeah, when she came back and I met her again at my local pub in the beginning of September 2013. She taps me on my shoulder and I turn around, outside on the patio. And I turn around, she goes, do you remember me? And I was like, oh my God. Yeah. I tried not to look that surprised.
Yeah, but you did.
Yeah, I think I masked it pretty well. I was like, oh yeah, sure, how's it going, how's your boyfriend, oh we broke up, oh bummer, how's everything here, oh we're separated, oh right on, cool, you know. So I started wooing her after that. Yeah, I walked her home.
So you wooed her by buying her a knife.
Yeah, flashlight was the first one, and then a knife was the next. Yeah pocket knife. Yep Walk her home, you know. Yep Yeah, I was taking it real slow. It didn't take us long. I mean, the fire was it was inevitable that we were gonna spontaneously combust. You know.
Yeah. So now you got this relationship that is so healthy for you. You're working on yourself. You're working on the business, but in the meantime, you got some pretty serious health problems.
Yeah.
I mean, you have that, you jumping out of airplanes, which is never good on your body. Right. You got into a motorcycle accident with a deer.
Yep.
So,
I've been banged up. I mean, I could, there's laundry list of me getting banged up. I mean, laundry list.
And then you get sick.
Yeah.
You have this rheumatoid condition that just knocks you on your ass.
Yep. Came out of nowhere. That started in May of 21.
Okay, maybe so. That's a little bit more recent.
Yep.
So
yeah, this. I mean, it's still ongoing. I still have it.
Yeah.
Polymyalgia rheumatica, PMR.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
So I know it zaps all your energy, all your strength,
and mobility. Yeah. Everything hurts all the time. Yeah. Bones, muscles, joints, everything. Yeah.
So what's your regimen to mitigate that?
Well, my regimen is a lot different than the medical community's regimen. The medical community treats. And how do they treat? Little orange bottles with white caps.
Yeah.
Poison. But the thing is, desperate times create desperation. So you'll take freaking anything if it's going to make you feel better. Because I couldn't navigate a flight of stairs. I couldn't drive a car. I could not reach for a coffee cup. I could not button a shirt. I could not open a bottle of water. And everything was excruciating. Everything. Nonstop. Yeah. And then with major inflammation comes all the fun stuff like nerve pain. So you're only sleeping 4 hours a night, and then comes IBS with inflammation. So you're, you know, peeing out of your butt 12 times a day for 2 years. The whole thing was absolutely freaking horrible. And Rebecca and I we're healthy. We eat well, we exercise, we work out, we're down to earth. But I started I got rid of all the orange bottles. I started becoming motivated by vanity. Yeah. Looking in the mirror and going, oh my God, I look like poop. Whew. Yeah. And we started going all natural. Mother Nature has everything to cure us. Everything. Yeah. Mother Nature does. We just call it pseudoscience now. Because there's no money in it. If you could grow it and take it and it makes you feel better, there's no money in it. As you could tell, I'm not a big fan of big pharma.
Yeah, I get it. My wife Sarah
says helicopters fly over my roof here in Tampa.
My wife Sarah says motion is medicine.
Motion is lotion.
So the watching your workouts, it's amazing that you have a condition like that.
Well, I didn't disclose it in open forum until I started feeling better. I didn't want a pity party, you know. Because I got a big fan base. I got a lot of people following me. I didn't want them all saying, oh, man, I hope you feel better. You know, screw that. But once I started feeling better, CJ and I did a podcast. My buddy CJ, we're owners and proprietors of the University of Badassery. So I did a podcast in detail of all of the everything that was bothering me, the steps I went to preventative measures, curing measures.
Yeah.
And one was getting off prescription meds, going all natural. I started craniosacral massage, infrared sauna, and doing, you know, the infrared sauna, the cold plunge, all that stuff, you know, that people know about. Yeah. My diet was already good because all I eat is food. I don't eat any product. And it's mostly meat, but meat and veg. Yeah. And I just started going a completely different route, a more holistic type of route. And that ended up squaring me away. I mean, it's still, you know, with chronic pain comes shitty disposition and deportment, you know, you're just in a bad mood or, you know, it just, you know, just plague, you know, it's nonstop. Yeah. It's like, ugh, you know, it's pukey. It feels nauseating, like in the back of the neck, and the shoulders and the hips.
Yeah. How do you blow up? You know, you got a veteran owned business that's doing well. You became this social media, like just this guru, like the king of social media. You embraced it when, frankly, a lot of, I think you mentioned on the podcast with Joe Rogan, a lot of veterans of our age don't. They're afraid of it. So how did that happen?
Well, I'm different, right, than all the veteran influencers you see out there. This is what I did. I'm an ex-Navy SEAL. I'm an ex-Marine Recon. I don't care. I'm not a rest on your morals, mamba jamba.
Yeah,
I mean, yes,
I've heard you say that.
I'm a badass yesterday, but I'm a badass tomorrow. I don't need to rest on my laurels. But and the other thing I noticed with the social is people were genuinely craving genuine. There's so much fake out there. There's so much fluff. There's so much phony.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just nauseating. You know, I started slow, but got a following quick. And then I started incorporating. There was one thing I started doing maybe in 2017. I started doing Sunday Sentinel sermons. Were just little PMAs. They were 30 to 40 second PSAs, public safety announcements, you know, basically from rules, little segments of my Sentinel book. And I started doing those and numbers increased. So I started clearing out all the fluff from my site. Like, people don't need to see what I'm eating. You know, that's so copy and paste. Everybody does that stuff. They don't need to see this. They don't need to see that. It doesn't need to be long. Attention span of human beings short. And then in 2019, I struck gold with another idea, which was basic dude stuff.
That's basic dude stuff is just a genius.
Dude, I mean, that game traction so fast that I had to do this.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? 6 months in. Copyright, right?
6 months in, I had a trademark. 6 months in. Because people were copying it. Because there's so many echoes out there, you know, in a void of people are void of imagination, creativity.
So what I love about Basic Dude Stuff is it's you. Right. It's probably things that you've done for a very long time. Normal every bit your life, like maintaining a garden, taking care of your weapons, you know, changing oil on all your machinery. Right. And you do it in a really quite humorous way.
Yeah, I mean, it's just everything that we human beings should be able to do. And it's not about dudes. Yeah. It's about people. It's all inclusive. It's all encompassing. Yeah. It's all people, you know, because just 100 years ago, we were perspicacious. We know how to do all the things. We could hunt it, kill it, eat it, fix it, mend it, repair it. You know, we could do all the stuff. You know, it wasn't that long ago. We could do all the stuff, all of us. Now there's men who can't even navigate the way to run a screwdriver. I went to a grown man's house a couple years ago, and he had something to fix. I said, I could fix that. Just bring my toolbox, your toolbox. He didn't have a toolbox in his house. He had a junk drawer with a Dollar General pliers and a Dollar General Phillips head screwdriver. And I'm going, what time am I at? How could this be a thing? Yeah, man. Yeah. I mean, and you know, it's not about dudes. Yeah. It's about people, human beings.
I got a business idea. You need to start teaching basic dude stuff classes.
Yeah, that's those ideas started in 2020. I mean, the amount of times I get that every week, every time I post one, people say, you need to start doing basic dude stuff classes. And it's not out of the realm of possibility now. And in fact, I have done it. I've been invited to events where the guy says, hey, we just want you to do basic dude stuff. So I'm like, well, given the event, we're going to do knots. We're going to do 3-to-1 ratio systems. And we're going to do improvised fire. And we're going to do improvised this, you know, and just whatever it is. Yep.
I love it. And then let's talk a little bit about how basic dude stuff morphed into a kid show.
So there was really... the only connection, because there's not a lot of connection there. Yeah. Okay. The connection one was months in to basic dude stuff. I started getting adults sending me videos of their kids doing basic dude stuff, you know, making your bed.
Wow.
Making your bed is basic dude stuff. You know, these little girls, little boys helping out with chores, basic dude stuff, you know, playing outside, you know, I mean, just, it went on and on. And then I thought, oh man, I got a kid following. I got to make sure that basic dude stuff is clean. No cusses, no tobacco, no alcohol, none of that. Yeah. So it's got to be clean. So anyway, I've never lost a child inside of me. You know what I mean? Never. I never have. I am still an 8-year-old at heart. I am full of wonder, you know, and still curiosity, which is a shame that adults, you know, we lose that as we get older.
Yeah.
Being full of wonder. In 2020, during pandemic coronation, the kids in the neighborhood started calling me Mr. Mastavio. No reason for it. I asked the originator, this little girl. I said, hey, why Mr. Mastavio? She goes, I don't know. I said, where'd you hear it from? She goes, I don't know. I just started calling you. So all the kids in the neighborhood. In my cul-de-sac, I think there are a dozen, 12 kids. They all call me Mr. Mastavio. All of them. And they just think, and that's what I answer to. They think that's my name. They know no different. I am not Pat Mack. I am Mr. Mastavio. So the notion of a kid's show was always on my mind, but Rebecca went to school to get another degree, social work. Right. Bless. And it was a horrible experience. She graduated and she would come home in tears. That's the system is broken, man, especially with little kids.
Yeah, absolutely. It's broken.
Yeah. The other thing that pains me is to see little kids void of curiosity. Parents will force tablets on them. I could get angry right now talking about this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've seen, only because I am not on a device when I'm out and about, I see things. Yeah. I pay attention.
It's the baby
watcher. But parents will force tablets and phones on kids. Even if they're looking around, they could just be doodling or, I don't know, looking at a bird in a tree. Nope, here's a device. Mm-hmm. Plopping at a restaurant, you know, too. Yeah. It's like, no, that's where a kid learns matters. That's where he learns to converse. That's where a parent talks to a child and vice versa. And I'm just mind blown. It's like, let's see how stupid we can make kids. Let's rob them. Let's rob them of curiosity, you know, of imagination. I'm going to say this with impunity because I believe it's true. I think you're better off, and it's healthier for a kid giving him a lit cigarette than it is a device while he's out and about, especially outside. He's better off getting a lit cigarette. So Rebecca would come home in tears, and one night we're sitting up here, and we're both emotional wrecks. And I said, Rebecca, we could be part of the problem or part of the solution. Let's be part of the solution. I said, I have this idea. I have no idea if it's going to morph into, and I still don't know if it's going to morph into anything. Because we just put out promos. It hasn't been popped out there in the interweb sphere.
Yeah.
So I started putting together these shorts. I figure if a kid is going to watch a show while he's outside on a device, he may as well watch me telling him to get outside. And the benefits of it, it's very fun. It's very fun, very innocent. It's designed for little kids. It's kind of, I call it a cool Mr. Rogers.
Yeah. I watched the promos. The promos are good. If I had $1 million and I don't, I would give you some to run with this because I think it's going to be huge.
Yeah, I told Rebecca last night, I asked her, I says, hey, do you think there will come a time in my life where I'm somewhere out and about and kids say, hey, Mr. Mostavio, you're strangers. And she goes, oh, that's going to happen.
Yeah, I believe
so. I start everyone the same way. And it's welcome back. I walk outside. Mr. Rogers walked inside. Mr. Rogers took off his loafers, put on his tennis. Yeah. And a wonderful day in the neighborhood. I love Mr. Big fan. Huge.
Yeah.
I got really stuck his neck out. He did stuff that was not popular. You know, boys are boys and girls are girls. Anyway, he really stuck his neck out. He was a champion for kids. Champion. So, but he would come in, take his loafers off, put his tennis on. I start each episode going outside, welcome, and I take my shoes off, and I walk barefoot in the grass. And it starts with, welcome back to Mr. Mostavio's World of Wonder, where it's cool to be curious, and where we will explore our world. You know, because there's so much, and I do most of it in my backyard.
Yeah,
my dog.
But you have an amazing, piece of property,
dude. It's only an acre.
It's only an acre.
Yep. I just do a lot with.
Yeah, you've done a whole lot with this. Yeah. So, and you're living in North Carolina. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So very, very cool. I can't wait to see it. I think it's going to be neat. Speaking of your property, you have a lot of really cool toys on your property. I like it to be your toys. I have a 68 Mustang.
Oh, bro.
So I've had for 30 years, but I can appreciate your goat. Yeah. So how'd you get your hands on that?
Oh man, cool story. Let me see. It was 2014, I think it was. No, 15, 2015. I had 10 years. I've always wanted an old muscle car. And if I could get a birth date one, that'd be even cooler, you know? Yeah. Yeah. Big fan of old American Muscle. I mean, like, I was a nerd when I was 12. You know, it bothered my dad. He says, you cannot become a grease monkey. Blah, blah, blah. I was like, but they're so cool. You know, these things are so cool. They're so cool. But I was in the gym, and I overheard a guy that was working out in there, and I knew him, and he was talking about his dad and the cars he owns. And I just overheard, but he's like, this car, that one. And none of them were special. You know, none of them were like the prime years, you know, like a 72 Camaro, a 71 Chevelle, you know, it's kind of like that stuff. You know what I'm saying? He didn't have the prime years. And then he goes in a 65 GTO. I say, Ryan, did you say your pops has a 65 GTO? And he goes, yeah. I said, damn, man, what's his plans? You think you ever part with it? He goes, and I was expecting, hell no. But he shrugs. He goes, I don't know. I'll ask him. I'm like, oh, all right. So he comes back a few days later and he says, yeah. I'm like, oh my God. And so I drove and I had an idea of what he was asking for it.
All right.
And I drove with Rebecca to north of Charlotte, little teeny town, and he's gone. He pulls up in it. And I'm like, oh man, this thing is so cool. She just oozes cool. Oozes. Because it's the first year of muscle car. You know, that DeLorean coined the term muscle car off the GTO. Yeah. And I had dollar bills. And I laid stacks of dollar bills of what I was going to pay for it. And it was a lot less, you know. Yeah. It was somewhat less than what he was asking. Yeah. And he's looking at those stacks. And he goes, nah, bro, I can't do it. I said, I don't blame you. I don't blame you. And I stacked it up. I said, nice chatting with you, you know, put that big freaking roll of dollar of hundreds back into my pocket. And Rebecca and I take off. We just got on, get on I-40. And Rebecca goes, I bet that dude calls his wife and tells him that you had this much money laid out in the hood. And she chews his ass and says, you should have taken it. And as soon as she finished saying that, my phone rings and it's him. And I look at her. I mean, it was not 2 seconds after she finished saying that. And I pick it up. He goes, and he, this is what he said. Hey, Mac. Well, I talked to my wife. So I spin around, you know, next exit, and I floor it back there. And yep, we did all the paperwork that day, title and everything. And I drove it back from Charlotte.
What a great story.
And then, you know, a lot of work, nickel and dime. A lot of nickel.
Yeah, when the we purchased that 68 Mustang when I was at Edwards Air Force Base for like $2,000.
Nice.
And it was from some of my late wife's pre-inheritance money. And we put a lot into it. And then,
is it a real car? In other words, original drivetrain?
Yeah, original.
No
everything.
Kidding. So hold on.
And no rust.
It's not a 289, it's a 351 or a
289.
Oh, cool. I love that little small car. Special. I think that's cooler. Yeah. You know, it doesn't have to be a muscle car. I think that if I told Rebecca, if I ever get a Mustang, I want that. I want that 289.
Yeah, it's awesome. So, you know, I put a Mako paint job on it because I was a poor staff sergeant. And then a retired, life got in front of me. I founded Vetlanta, which is a large veteran organization I run. Yep. Got my master's degree and just let it sit. And then when she passed away, I had a newer Mustang. I took it to a car wash, and I was spending this was maybe like 4 or 5 days after she passed away, and I'm spending way too much time on it. And I have this Vietnam veteran who comes pulling up next to me, and he's got a Shelby, totally badass, a newer one. But and then I'm very outgoing, but I don't often talk to strangers at a car wash, and just felt the need to talk with this guy and said, hey, I like your car. And then he goes, I like yours too. And he saw something in my eyes. He's like, what's going on with you? And we had this great conversation.
Oh, cool.
Said my late wife just passed away. You know, I brought up the story of this 68 Mustang and he goes, hey, look, if you're going to sell it, don't put another dime into it. Just sell it. But if you have the money to honor her, go put more money than it's ever going to be.
Right.
Worth.
Right.
And that's what I did.
Yeah. Good.
So but if I'm feeling down or depressed or stressed, I would take that car for a ride and it just equals me out.
Yeah. Very cool.
So let's talk a little bit about your business again. So can you let our viewers know exactly what you do? Because I know, I think it's pretty badass.
Yeah. So
talk about the services.
I think one of the lessons I learned being in business for yourself is don't put all your eggs in one basket. I learned that the hard way a couple times. So I have my own business, T-Max Inc. And I run shooting courses and private shooting courses as well. But I have a series of other ventures. I have an online coaching squad, the Pat Mac Keep the Blaze Live coaching squad on Patreon. we do a lot of life lessons, life coaching. CJ Ortiz and I, you know, he's my business partner in that.
Yeah,
he's great. He's freaking awesome. And I own a coffee company, Invader Coffee. I have books and DVDs. Yeah. I sell fitness programming, combat strength training. I sell my own brand of resistance bands that get you some bands. There's more. I don't know. It's hard to keep track of sometime.
I know your classes that you teach are always sold out. So they're hard to get into. Yep. But let's talk about the coffee. The coffee business is a super competitive business. So what sets your coffee apart?
The quality of it. So most people, when they sell coffee, they're selling a gimmick or a gizmo or a gadget. Bikinis and machine guns, that kind of thing. You know, and people buy it because...
a company that does that.
I mean, people buy it because they want to be a part of the brand. You know, the coffee's crap, but the brand is cool. You know, we can do this and that and be outrageous. So our coffee, we're based in Austin, Texas. We source from all over the world, and we air roast. Only 1% of the coffee out there you buy is air roasted. So, of course, it's a more expensive and laborious process, but the bean... Damn, you harness the flavor from the whole bean, and it reduces the amount of acidity. So it's a really, really good coffee. One of the things we talk about, you know, when you make a pot of coffee and it goes cold and later on you warm it up and it tastes horrible, Invader, because of the lack of acidity and everything, still tastes great if you warm it.
Awesome.
Wow. Yeah. But it's not just because it's mine. It's good. And I don't even drink that much coffee anymore. I'm like two cups a day. I'm one cup in the morning and one cup at 3 in the afternoon.
All right.
But man, when I drink it, I want it to be quality.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm the same way. So how can our viewers find your coffee?
InvaderCoffee.com.
Okay, yep.
InvaderCoffee.com. Or they can find, viewers can find just about anything that I am affiliated with. Off of, like, if they're on IG, my T-Max Inc. IG site, my link in bio has everything that I'm affiliated with. Everything.
Cool. Yeah, it's a I love it. You're a hustler.
Yeah.
Yeah, I consider myself a hustler in a good way, in the best sense. You're not resting on your laurels. Right. You're always looking for the next thing. I greatly admire it. Another thing I greatly appreciate. I'm big on LinkedIn. I've touched base with you on LinkedIn just a couple times, including inviting you to this podcast, and you replied back. And I appreciate it. I'm the same way. So if you're connecting with me on LinkedIn, I'm going to get back to you. I can't always help you out,
right?
But I can definitely owe you a response. And, and so Mac, I greatly appreciate that.
You are welcome, my man.
I'm gonna offer you an opportunity to give, say there's a veteran out there or a service member that's struggling. Mm-hmm. What advice can you offer?
Be preemptive. You know, that's a big one. I think just reach out. Just touch base. Just show up. Just ask a question. Just invite that person out. Don't stroke them, pat them on the back, because here's the thing. If they're really struggling, and it's going to be hard to recognize the signs and symptoms. You know, there's a lot of people out there that put on a front, a struggling front. The guys I know, man, the signs, they're very minuscule. They're slight, but I could recognize them. Yeah. So you got to reach out, send a text. Hey, checking up on you, buddy. Check. Rebecca does it. She has a list of people that she's friends with through me that are like retired military guys, or they're vets or retired LEOs. And every once in a while, she sends out an all call buddy check.
Well, that's awesome. Well, yeah, tell Rebecca I said thanks for doing that, because that's something I preach as well. So Mac, appreciate you, buddy. Thank you for your service in the military. But most of all, thank you for everything you're doing now, especially for the kids that rocks. Yeah. So I'm going to end this how I always end my podcasts. Be safe, be kind, and be remarkable.
The Tango Tango podcast is proudly sponsored by Supply Chain Now. Join the Tango Tango community for more inspiring stories. Follow us on Facebook, X, and LinkedIn. Subscribe to the Tango Tango YouTube channel. And follow and listen to Tango Tango wherever you get your podcasts.